Headline, to dedicate a temple of Baha'i on Chicago's North Shore, January 7, 1912, Chicago. Publication, unknown. Abdul Baha Abbas is coming to America. His followers are anticipating his presence in Chicago during the annual Baha'i Convention that meets early in May to accelerate the project out in Willamette of the Mashra el-Aqsa, Dawning Point of Prayer, a house of worship that is to be the outward symbol of the universal teaching of Baha'u'llah, which Abdul Baha will proclaim. He has been in London and Paris, his first visit to the West, during a life of exile and imprisonment. Press, pulpit, people, all races, all creeds, united to do him honor. Greetings were sent to him on his arrival by the London Baha'is, the Theosophical Society of Bristol, the Christian Commonwealth, reverently welcomed him, the Theosophical Society of London, the Brahma Soma Center, and many social settlements. Dr. Campbell invited him to address his congregation at the City Temple. Canon Wilberforce extended to him the courtesy of St. John's Westminster. London accorded him a continuous reception. The Lord Mayor asserted the city was honored by his presence. Americans crossed the Atlantic to greet this simple man of the East. Paris extended to him the same cordial welcome. Nearly 20 years ago, a group of men and women met in one of the clubrooms of the Masonic Temple, that hive of cult and creeds, to listen to a soft-voiced Persian elucidating the principles of a religion he defined as Baha'i. A few of those who heard him grasped the idea and held fast to it. Through the intervening years, they have gathered strength and numbers. Until now, they have united in the purchase of a tract of ground on the North Shore, where they are planning to build a temple, which they hope that Abbas Effendi, head of Baha'ism, will arrive for the laying of the cornerstone when he comes to Chicago in the spring. For Abbas Effendi, Abdul Baha is touring the Western world. A religion without priests. What is Baha'ism, and who is Abbas Effendi? Thousands of native-born Americans would be able to answer offhand and at any length these questions that would be Greek to the average reader. For in the last two decades, Baha'ism has spread through the United States with amazing celerity, considering that it is a religion without priest, creed, or definite form of worship. The followers of the religion define Baha'ism as a spirit of religion rather than a cult. Baha'ism is an embracing belief, claiming love and unity as its only principles and uniting on them followers of other religions. There are assemblies in New York, Boston, Washington, Los Angeles, Oakland, Seattle, and in Kenosha. But Chicago, ever inclusive of new forms of religious belief, heads the country in the number and strength of Baha'i. Who is Abdul Baha Abbas? What is the compelling power that draws men to him? Abdul Baha is the center of the Baha'i movement, the movement that is accomplishing the unification of religions, universal peace, and brotherhood. He is the center of the covenant, Baha'is say. He is the spiritual guide of millions who strive to follow him, though from afar. He is, by his own statement, the servant of Baha, servant of the ineffable splendor. After all the attempts at definition and analysis, Abdul Baha remains the great mystery. Now, the history of the Baha'i movement becomes a thrilling tale of persecution, exile, imprisonment of leader and followers, beginning with the arrest and imprisonment of Baha'u'llah in 1852, and terminating with the liberation of Abdul Baha by the new Turkish government in the summer of 1908. Nowadays, many know the external facts of the story, how Baha'u'llah with his family and followers were exiled in 1852 to Baghdad, in 1862 to Constantinople, then to Adrianople, where they remained 5 years, and in 1868 to the penal town of Akka, on the coast of the Mediterranean in Syria, how for 2 years they were imprisoned, 70 men, women, and children, in the military barracks under most harrowing conditions, and how they left the prison, though by official edict, Baha'u'llah was compelled to remain within the doors for 9 years, and then how the freedom of Akka and the surrounding country was granted him until his death on May 22, 1892. Persecution, torture, martyrdoms, more than 20,000 of them, only increased the fervor and number of followers. Baha'is are found in almost every country of the world. In Europe and America, the cult is spreading swiftly. And Persia, the instigator of the original persecutions, has suffered so complete a tour de force that she today is more than one-third Baha'i. During the exile and imprisonment of Baha'u'llah, he was giving utterance to teachings for the illumination and guidance of men, that men may cease theorizing about the essential truths of life and put them into practical expression. These utterances insist upon oneness of God, the one divine source of all religions, and hence their unity. The manifestations of the Word of God through great messengers, Abraham, Moses, Zoroaster, Jesus, Muhammad, Baha'u'llah, universal peace, a universal language, the equality of men and women, and the equal education advantages. Before the death of Baha'u'llah, he revealed the Kitabiyyah, the Book of Covenant, creating Abbas Effendi, his eldest son, the center of the covenant. Always there has been a peculiar bond of understanding with Abdu'l-Bahá, and during the long journey with Baha'u'llah of exile and imprisonment that ended with the most great prison of Akka, he never attended school. From his father, he received instruction, and early he acquired the power he manifests today of meeting people of every race, class, and creed. Early, too, came evidences of the boundless knowledge and wisdom that impresses men today, whether or not they recognize his spiritual station. Abbas Effendi, the Prophet. Abbas Effendi, for 40 years a prisoner and released less than 4 years ago, he converted a third of the Persian nation to his belief and has spread his doctrine to scattered gatherings throughout the world. To his house in Haifa come pilgrims from all over the world, but it is declared that even while he was jailed, scores of Americans came to visit him. He is described as a wonderful old man, so highly respected even among the more fanatical Mohammedans, that many Mohammedan ecclesiastics of distinction have stopped at Haifa on their journeys to Mecca to pay him visits of respect. Abbas Effendi is declared a prophet, although he refuses to set store by the gift of prophecy, declaring that the spirit is the essential point of religion. His father ordered burned a book which proclaimed the supposed miracles of the Bab, insisting that its publication might prove cause for the latter superstition. Abbas Effendi, who has aroused the interests of London, the only city that excels Chicago as a cherisher of cults and creeds, seems to be able to impress nearly all those who meet him with his power of personality. Travelers to Akka have been coming back year after year with tales of the potent personality of Abbas Effendi. So great was his magnetic power that no governor of Akka was allowed to remain in that district more than a year. The government feared that continued residence near the Effendi would undermine the Mohammedism of the very men whom it sent to represent it. One of the most vivid descriptions written of the Effendi is that given by Professor Edward Granville Brown of Oxford, who visited him while he was still a prisoner at Akka. "Seldom have I seen one whose appearance impressed me more," he wrote of him. "A strongly built man, holding himself straight as an arrow, with white turban and raiment, long locks reaching almost to the shoulders, broad, powerful forehead, indicating a strong intellect combined with an unswerving will, eyes keen as a hawk's, and strongly marked with pleasant features. Such was my first impression of Abbas Effendi, the master. An American who visited Akka in 1892 described the man and his surroundings in more extended detail. Imagine that we are in the ancient house of the still more ancient city of Akka. The room in which we are faces the opposite wall of a narrow paved street, which an active man might clear in one bound. Above is the bright sun of Palestine, to the right, a glimpse of the formidable sea wall and the blue Mediterranean. As we sit, we hear the singular sound rising from the pavement 30 feet below, faint at first and increasing. It is like the murmur of human voices. We open the window and look down. We see a crowd of human beings with patched and tattered garments. Many of these men are blind. Many more are pale or emaciated or aged. Some are on crutches, some are so feeble that they can hardly walk. Most of the women are closely veiled, but enough are uncovered to cause us well to believe that if the veils were lifted, more pain and misery would be seen. Some of them carry babes with pinched and yellow faces. There are perhaps 100 in the gathering besides many children. They are of all the races one meets in these streets, Turks, Syrians, Arabs, Ethiopians, and many others. These people are ranged against the walls or seated on the ground, apparently in an attitude of expectation. A door opens and a man comes out. He is of middle stature and strongly built. He wears flowing, light-colored robes. On his head is a light buff fez with white cloth bound around it. He is perhaps 60 years of age. His long hair rests on his shoulders. His forehead is broad, full, and high, his nose slightly aquiline. His mustache and beard, the latter full though not heavy, are nearly white. His eyes are gray and blue, large, and both soft and penetrating. His bearing is simple, but there is grace, dignity, and even majesty about his movements. A friend of the poor. He passes through the crowd, and as he goes, utters words of salutation. We do not understand them, but we see the benignity and the kindliness of his countenance. He stations himself at a narrow angle of the street and motions to the people to come toward him. They crowd up a little too insistently. He pushes them quietly back and lets them pass one by one. As they come, they hold their hands extended. In each open palm, he places some small coin. He knows them all. He caresses them with his hands on the face, on the shoulders, on the head. Some he stops and questions. An aged Negro who hobbles up is greeted by him with some kindly query. The old man's broad face breaks into a sunny smile, his white teeth glistening against his ebony skin as he replies. He stops a woman with a babe and fondly strokes the child. As they pass, some kiss his hand. To all he says, "Merhaba, merhaba, well done, well done." This man who gives thus freely must be rich, you think? No, far otherwise. Once his family was the wealthiest in Persia. For 50 years, however, he and his family have been exiles and prisoners. But even his jailers have become his friends and honor and respect him as though he were their brother. For to this man, it is the law to do good to those who injure him, and no one wants to injure him when he comes to know him. An American woman, Miss Ethel Safana Stevens, has written of the Effendi of Haifa. Almost any afternoon you can see him for yourself if you will stroll in the streets of Haifa, that half-Syrian, half-Teutonic village where ragged Turkish roustabouts load cargo from a pier, which was built for the German emperor to land on. This servant of Baha is a man with shrewd, kindly, courteous eyes that seem to look into you instead of at you, but that instinctively make you like him, and all that goes with them. A keen, suntanned, friendly face, framed as in silver by his long white hair and beard. An expression that is alert, intelligent, and serene. A walk that is dignified without being conscious. A carriage that is peculiarly commanding. In him you see an Old Testament patriarch personified. Always he wears the snowy turban, the robe of plain white linen, and the gray wool undergarment peculiar to all Persians of high standing, while behind him, at the distance prescribed by respect, walks a group of his disciples with folded hands. Regard him well, my friends, she continues, for in him you behold one of the most significant figures in the religious world of today. No one is perhaps more for the uplifting of the Oriental than any other force, one who has actually suffered for his faith, one whom nearly 2 millions of people hold in greatest reverence as the light in the lantern, the knowledge within the gate. The religion of Abbas Effendi, which was brought to this country by a few returning American tourists and a few Persian disciples of the Baha, has been gaining force in Chicago for several years. Mrs. Marshall Rowe, well known for her work as a volunteer probation officer and as the originator of the Tag Day idea for the children's charities, is one of the original disciples of the Baha'i in Chicago. Mrs. Rowe's charity work in behalf of the neglected children of the city is part of her conception of Baha'ism. For charity is one of the watchwords of the Baha'i faith. Love is the fundamental spirit of Baha'i, says Mrs. Rowe. Baha'i is not a cult, in that those who become Baha'is must give up any other creed or religion with which they are associated. Baha'ism is inclusive. Love is the beginning and end of all. Religions are lights. All religions are lights on the path towards perfection. Baha'ism is the all-pervading religion. Sympathy, unselfishness, love for God, and love for man, a divine thought of humanity, are the essentials of Baha'i. To build temple in Chicago. The Baha'i faith has no cult, no set creed, no priests, no fixed order of prayers. Baha'u'llah has written a book of beautiful, inspirational prayers, but these are not a fundamental part of Baha'i. The best prayer is the thought of others with a love that seeks service for them and all-pervading kindliness. The temple which we hope to have built soon in Chicago, and for which we have already purchased the ground north of Devon Avenue, is to be a symbol of our faith. Baha'i require no temple except in the heart. The aim of the Baha'is is to establish an earthly kingdom of love, where the only law shall be the law of love one another. Baha'i is a universal religion. Abdu'l-Bahá has said in this that religious conceptions of every creed prescribe the existence of a medium between man and God. The spiritual teachings of these divine mediums, whether Hebrew, Muslim, or Christian, have been essentially alike. The Word of God, whether transmitted by Moses, Christ, Muhammad, what, after all, are these but names? And what do names, mere words, matter? Yet people quarrel and even kill each other over those names. The true object of religion is to make every soul reflect the divine. That is the mission of the Baha'i. We must obey Abbas Effendi in working for the service of humanity. Love is the beginning and the end of all life. The triumph of humanitarian love would end all human disputes. All great religions of the world have preached love, some in greater, some in less degree. Abbas Effendi hopes for the time when nations will no longer war with each other, when the provincial prejudice, which is called patriotism, will be replaced by a higher ideal of good to all, and when a universal language will be taught, when genius will be directed not towards destruction, but towards alleviation of all the sufferings of men. To be Baha'i means to have attained to the spirit of love for others. Love for God must be shown in love for mankind. The Baha'is try to serve humanity and to work for the universal peace and universal brotherhood of man. The teachings of Baha'u'llah. The revelation of Baha'u'llah is the exaltation of the simple, rational life, and Abdul Baha its exemplification. What he utters as the servant of his father is of vital interest. Love, he declares, is the beginning foundation, saying that many of the material problems should be solved first to prepare the way for the reception of spiritual truth. Such people, said Abdul Baha, are doing the work of true religion. Then he went on to say that a new order of things must come, but it must have a solid foundation, and that no foundation was solid save religion, which was the love of God. When this unshakable basis of the love of God was established in the world, then inevitably would the structure of a new social justice arise, and a new individual love and understanding. Often the question is asked, what is the Baha'i's attitude toward the theosified teaching of reincarnation? And Abdul Baha replies, in the teaching of Baha'u'llah, the reincarnation of the spirit in successive bodies is not taught, but Abdul Baha emphasizes the harmonies rather than the differences between the Baha'i revelations and other systems of philosophy and other religious expressions, its real oneness with all that is true and good in every progressive movement. For as one adherent to the faith explains, Baha'ism is pure and unadulterated universalism, such as was the prophetic spirit of all religions. Upon woman, a high station is conferred by the revelation of Baha'u'llah. There is no limit to her attainment. She will come into her own spiritually and intellectually. In Paris, when the news came of the Battle of Benghazi, Abdul Baha was greatly distressed, and to those assembled about him he said, I am not happy this morning, I am full of sadness. The news which the paper brought us was such as must fill one with anguish. Animals fight, and when they fight, it is for a cause, an end to be gained. Men are fighting now for what? For the ground? Our sepulchre? Our tomb? Our cemetery. This earth is the first and lowest of terrestrial things created by the divine will, and it is our tomb, our sepulchre, our cemetery, our death, not our life. And these men are fighting not for liberty or an ideal and brotherhood among men. While these men are creating death, do you think life, while they are guilty of cruelty, you think tenderness. While they make destruction, you think construction. While they create war, you think peace. We must hope, we must not despair. We must look forward to the time when war and dissension will disappear, when love and unity will reign, and the light of God will shine upon all banners and into all hearts and unite them to one another and to Him.